Welcome to Simoncast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I'm John Shaw, the director of the Institute. In Simoncast, we aim to keep the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well through wide-ranging civil conversations.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Shannon McGregor, a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Shannon is doing some really important work in the world of political communication, social media. She is the assistant professor at the Hussman School of Journalism and Media at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and also is a senior researcher at the Center for Information Technology and Public Life. She works a lot on the role of digital and social media in our political system, and is just doing some really creative work. Going back a little bit, she has an undergraduate degree in communications and journalism from Flagler College, a master's from the University of Florida, and a doctorate from the University of Texas in Austin. She's taught at the University of Florida, UT Austin, and the University of Utah before coming to Chapel Hill. She's written an awful lot in the field, lots of peer-reviewed articles, and actually is co-editor of a book called Digital Discussions, How Big Data Informs Political Communication. So she joins us today from her office in Chapel Hill. So Shannon, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about your kind of intellectual journey in the world of political communications. Has this always been something that has sort of grabbed you as you went through undergraduate and then graduate school?
Yeah, probably even earlier than that. My dad was a journalist, and my mom, career-wise, was a nurse, but was always involved in politics and in activism. And so I was exposed to all sorts of political communication from an early age. And I practiced journalism, you know, in high school and in college and after college. And when I went and got my master's degree at the University of Florida, I took my first political communication class. It was a PhD level seminar from Dr. Linda Lee Cade, who is no longer with us, but is a legend in the field. And it totally turned me on to research and how I could think about the things that I was interested in, like politics and journalism, but instead of practicing them, that I could sort of look at it from this sort of more 10,000 foot gaze, right? And so after a couple years of teaching and working in journalism after my master's degree, I decided that I really wanted to do this. And when I entered my PhD program in 2013 at UT Austin, I knew I wanted to study very vaguely. I went and read my application essay, like when I was graduating, I was like, oh, that was quite vague. But I was like, oh, there's something going on with like social media and journalism and political campaigns. And that's what I want to study. And even in 2013 and 2014, I had people at conferences saying like, I don't think Twitter really matters that much for journalism or for politics. And I was like, well, I think it does. And now here we are, where I would say it likely matters too much in some cases, but it's nonetheless important to study, obviously, for the impact that it does have.
Well, Shannon, we have an audience with wide background. So let's maybe start out a little bit with briefly on some definitional matters, so we all kind of understand the parameters. And so when we think of social media, I mean, we hear the word bandied around a lot, but a couple of questions. One, what does it mean to you? What is social media? What are the major platforms as it pertains to the political world? And third, you mentioned Twitter. What is Twitter's role in this kind of constellation of social media platforms, again, in context of politics?
Yeah, so I think just at its base level, social media is any type of platform that allows people to communicate with one another, right? So rather than it being like broadcast, like television, right, where you're just receiving, social media is there's a two-way or many-way communication. I think the platforms that we think of most are things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Now also we think of TikTok and Snapchat, but I always think it's important to remember YouTube is a social media channel, right? There is a lot of social interaction on that site as well, Reddit. And now we have this sort of explosion of different social media platforms that have been sort of built to avoid a lot of the content moderation that takes place on some of those more mainstream social media sites. So places like Gab and Parler, and of course, President Trump's own Truth Social are places where there is supposedly less censorship in the political sphere. And so we've seen, you know, the scope of platforms widen, especially as it relates to politics. I think that several social media platforms play pretty significant roles in politics in different ways. So it was announced just yesterday that Meta is going to allow the former President Trump to reinstate his account on Facebook and Instagram if he chooses to do so. The same was on Twitter recently, but he hasn't tweeted yet, preferring to use his own platform. In particular, Facebook is really important for political campaigns for its ability to target advertising to people, right? Has the sort of largest user base, and so has really wide capabilities to be able to target messages in that way. Different platforms like TikTok, Instagram Stories, Snapchat reach a much younger audience that, you know, whether it's a political campaign or social movement or news outlet are trying to reach. But Twitter plays this very particular role. Not that many people are on Twitter. I haven't seen any results, any sort of data at how many people as like a share of, for example, the US American public since Elon Musk took over. But before that, it usually hovers around 21 to 23% of the American public. Certainly not representative of the American public, right? But journalists are on Twitter. And they have been since the beginning. And so because journalists flocked to Twitter in the beginning, it became this really important place for politics. So then political figures flock to Twitter because they know that they can reach journalists that way, try and sort of like shape the news agenda. And it has become this sort of like central place where politics happens.
Well, let's talk about social media, maybe Twitter specifically, and how it affects journalism. And I know you've done some really important research there, done a lot of surveying of journalists. And the one thing that you seem to have found pretty conclusively is that journalists rely on social media, we'll say Twitter, a lot. And maybe, although you don't necessarily make this judgment, perhaps more than they should, or at least perhaps uncritically. You wrote a paper with a colleague and you say, you know, we argue the social media platforms, Twitter in particular, have situated themselves as purveyors of legitimated content, a projection that journalists have not fully challenged and at times have abetted. Instead, journalists rely on these platforms both for access to powerful users and conduits to surface the words of ordinary people. This practice treats tweets more like content than sources. So expand on your findings here.
Yeah, so this was a paper, sort of, I guess, the second in a series that I've been working on with my colleague, Logan Molyneux, who's a professor at Temple. And very briefly, the first paper that we did together, we did a survey experiment with journalists. And so what we found was that journalists, we showed them either AP headlines or tweets that were of the same content. And journalists who spent time on Twitter said that the tweets were more newsworthy than AP headlines. And so we were like, okay, that sort of matches our hypothesis, but wow. And so then we started to think about how, right? Like, how does this happen beyond just journalists being on Twitter? And so in the second study that you're reading from, we really wanted to see like, how do journalists treat tweets when they do appear in stories? So we looked at a year's worth of stories across, you know, dozens of outlets of all different types in the US news media, and looked at stories that had a tweet in them, whether it was embedded or quoted or referenced in some way. And, you know, central to the idea of journalism is sourcing, right? Like, I have an undergrad journalism degree. I've been in journalism schools almost my whole career as a student and a professor. And there's, you know, the old adage, like, if your mother says she loves you, get a second source, right? But what we found in looking at how journalists were treating tweets and stories is they weren't really treating them as sources. They were just passing them on as content that was, you know, sort of pre-legitimated in some way, not having a second source for it, which, you know, I hesitate to say whether it's all good or all bad, right? Like, in some cases, this does mean things that we might consider not necessarily normatively desirable, or certainly strong journalistic practice, like passing on a politician's quote that happens to come on Twitter without contesting it or contextualizing it. But it also means things like using tweets from social movement activists, right? Like the Black Lives Matter movement, which allowed people who had historically been excluded from mainstream media conversations to have a voice in the mainstream media conversation around racial justice. And so we can see, you know, those are just two examples, but it's not all good or all bad, right? It's complicated depending on what it sort of looks like in a story and who and what type of message is being passed along through these social media posts.
Well, I know newsrooms across the country around the world are grappling with, you know, how to use Twitter and so forth. And I was reading an article, I think, in the Columbia Journalism Review about the kind of roiling within the New York Times. And they quoted the then executive editor, a memo that he sent out to his staff. And it was a long memo, but the one line that jumped out at me was an admonishment to, quote, tweet less, tweet more thoughtfully, and devote more time to reporting. And to unpack that, I think there's like two things that jump out at me. One, the notion of, and I was a reporter for many years, and I sometimes wondered if, you know, relying on Twitter kind of was displacing actual reporting. And people were just kind of sitting at home, you know, writing up tweets. So just, you know, how Twitter is affecting reporting, but also just the way reporters have felt sometimes compelled to have a social media presence and kind of hold forth on topics that maybe they're not necessarily expert in or should be objective about. So unpack those issues, if you would.
Yeah. I've also read this and have been sort of looking at how other outlets have handled their, you know, sort of in-house guidelines for how reporters should use social media in general, but Twitter in particular. I think the idea that they should use Twitter less and do more reporting is a little bit of a false binary, does it replace having a live interview where you can ask someone questions, challenge what they're saying, especially powerful people? Absolutely not, right? And it shouldn't. But there are also cases where people are not giving access to the press, but they are tweeting. And so at least then it's a way to see what a politician is saying, maybe contest it or challenge it in the story, provide context to it, et cetera. But if our job, you know, if the job of a reporter is to especially hold powerful people to account, if they won't talk to you, which we saw increasingly in the run-up to the 2022 midterms, that, a fair amount of Republican candidates across the country were simply not granting interviews to local news, to mainstream news, not allowing them access to their, you know, campaign events or speeches. Reporters in that case can be quite hamstrung, right, in terms of, you know, trying to present what is this person who's running for office in your district say or think or do, right? And so I think it's a bit of a false binary, but I think that, you know, it is a hard thing to balance as a journalist, especially given, you know, the New York Times may be an exception in this case, but given, you know, the increasingly, you know, shrinking budgets of newsrooms and you know, journalists are being asked to do more and more and more for less and less and less. And if there are sources right there, right, for you to look at, then of course that's a thing that is going to be a compelling thing to turn to. And then what was the second part of the quote that you were reading?
So it was about just reporters having a presence and sort of, you know, speaking on issues that maybe either they're covering directly and expressing personal opinions or expressing personal opinions on topics that are maybe unrelated to what they cover.
Yeah, I think that really gets at a reckoning that's happening in journalism more broadly, which is the challenge to the notion of objectivity as a core feature of reporting. You know, there's been a lot of pushback on that ideal, especially from, you know, journalists who are from historically marginalized communities, Black journalists, LGBTQ journalists, saying, you know, whose reporters have, you know, editors have sometimes said, well, we don't know if you can cover this because, like, you may be too close to it because of some identity that you have, but the same thing has not often been said to, you know, white people in general, and especially the very white male dominated field of journalism that we still have, but certainly, you know, decades ago was more sort of narrow along those lines. And I think it gets at this challenge of this notion of objectivity, because can a person have an opinion and still be a fair reporter on a topic. I think most journalists would say, like, yes, of course you can. The difference is that now we can see, right, these opinions if they're being shared on Twitter. But I think there really are these changing notions of, like, is objectivity something that should be strived for, or is it, you know, especially in thinking about how little trust people have in the media, might it help regain trust to just say, this is what I think about something or my background on something, and here is the story, right? And you can judge for yourself whether or not you think I've let some, you know, bias creep into it, but I'm not gonna, as a human, you know, and a journalist, pretend that I'm not a human who has, you know, identities and a past and experiences. So I think it really, that gets at that, because these opinions that journalists have, you know, probably always had, they're humans, are now just more apparent, right, to audiences, but also to their editors.
I was reading an article about Twitter, and there was a gentleman, a sports reporter, as it happened, from the Boston Globe, who said, Twitter is once so great and so horrible. What do you think he meant by that, Art?
I mean, I think everyone who's very much on Twitter, and I will certainly count myself in that category, sort of feels that way about it. Like, it is great and it is awful. It is great because it is, you know, you can learn breaking news on it. You can understand how people that you'll never meet, you know, in real life feel about something. You can be exposed to whole communities of people that you might otherwise not, you know, have come into contact with. It's also really funny. Like, you know, there's like a joke every day on Twitter, and like a main character, you know, as we call it, that like everyone's sort of making fun of, and that's fun, right? Like, so it's fun. But it's also horrible because it all the time, are on it all the time. And so you also are exposed to you know, sort of downsides of being around a bunch of people all the time, even if it's virtually, right? So like the snide remarks and the, you know, like reply guys of, you know, you say something, people are like, well, what about this? Or, well, actually it's this. Those more benign things, to like also harassment and threats that happen, you know, to people on Twitter, especially women, and especially women of color. I think that people who are on Twitter love it, but also hate it for those reasons. And because Twitter, like many social media, can be a place where you're on it, and then all of a sudden you look up and you're like, it's been an hour and a half of my life. And like, I did not enjoy that hour and a half, but like, oh my gosh, right? Like, I have other stuff to do, right? You can sort of get sucked into it, and that can make it feel terrible too. Even when you're legitimately using it for work, still never feels like you're actually working.
Let's talk a little bit about social media and campaigning. And you made an allusion to this for the 2022 midterms, but how has it changed campaigning? And I was particularly struck by something that you had said in one of your articles about presidential campaigns, in which now, as I understood your point, social media, a representative, is sort of assigned to the campaign and serves as kind of liaison, partly maybe to sell ads, but also to have this dialogue and to be kind of a conduit between the platform and the campaign. Talk about that that development.
Yeah, so this was something that we saw happen in the 2016 presidential campaign, at least the first time that we, you know, understood it from like a research and reporting perspective as well. And in that case, you know, the folks that I spoke to at places like Facebook and Twitter and Google, you know, likened it to any other big advertising account. You're a big enough account, you get, you know what I mean, right? Like a sort of dedicated sales rep, account manager, whatever, right? Politics isn't the same as like Coke or Pepsi, right? It does have this really different impact. And so what we saw in 2016, which the companies no longer do, but in 2016 offered to even embed those, you know, sort of representatives within the campaign. And we saw that sort of taken up differently in 2016. The Clinton campaign had a really robust digital team, and they were like, no, we're good, thanks. But Trump, you know, surprising himself and everyone else when he became the general, entered the general campaign as the party's nominee, had skeleton crew across all levels of the campaign, but in digital also. And so welcomed those, you know, representatives from Facebook and Twitter, you know, into their offices. After that, after our my colleague Daniel Kreese and I's work on that, you know, the company said they weren't gonna do that anymore. But it doesn't mean there's not still a dedicated person. And even within these social media companies, they're on the political ads and political comm side. There are they sort of mirror the way that digital firms or consulting firms operate more broadly, which is they're partisan, right? So there's like a Republican team and a Democratic team, right? Who work with candidates who are affiliated with those parties. And that's, I don't think necessarily bad. That's sort of how it works in political comms, online, offline, you know, more broadly. But it does allow, you know, political candidates or campaigns who have this person, right, that they have a relationship with, who works for the social media platform, different levels of access around things like content moderation, data sharing, you know, than other people do, right, who don't have that same access. And so I think that, you know, can limit in some ways the equity, right, that people experience, even if, you know, maybe they're a, you know, a budding challenging candidate, are not going to have that same level of access, right, as someone who's an incumbent and who has had this relationship with someone, say, inside Facebook or Google for 10 years. And I think that's probably a problem. And you asked in the beginning too about why is it so important for campaigns, you know, to use some of these platforms. And we talked about a little bit about that already, but I wanted to touch on it also in the news of, you know, Meta announcing that Trump could come back to Facebook or to Instagram. And, you know, like same as Elon Musk said that he could come back to Twitter and he hasn't taken him up on that, but there's a huge difference in that Facebook and Instagram are mega platforms for political ads, right? And for targeted political ads. Twitter's not. Even when they had political ads, they took them away. Then there was some talk about them, you know, coming back again. But it's such a smaller audience, right? It's just not as powerful as it is on Facebook or Instagram. I suspect very much that either Trump himself or at least the campaign will definitely come back to Facebook and Instagram because it is just such a powerful way for them to be able to reach people through targeted advertising. And I imagine the millions of dollars that campaigns at the presidential level are going to spend on those platforms certainly played a role in the decision to allow him to come back as well, right? If he's going to, you know, at least now, the only nominee, right, for the Republican Party.
Well, let's talk for a second about like down ballot races. And I don't know if the research has been definitive here, but and you made it a reference to the 2022 midterms, but is there evidence that candidates are spending, you know, less time going door to door and doing retail politics and just saying, hey, it's much more, you know, much more efficient for my time and energy to be focusing on social media and getting my message out that way?
I don't think it's a trade-off in campaigns as much as something, you know, they do sort of different things for you, right, as a campaign. You know, social media can help with awareness if you're a challenger, especially if you're sort of new to the political scene, right? It's a very cost-effective way to try and just become known, right, within your constituency. But I don't think that replaces, you know, field offices, right? Or things like that. They, you know, when I've talked to campaigns, those two teams talk to one another, right? About like what's working and who have we been able to reach or not been able to reach, right? To sort of bring both things to it. But I think, you know, one of the things that has been, I think, very good in general for politics and especially I think in the case of down ballot races that you're talking about is that social media, having a social media presence, advertising on social media is very cheap compared to other types of advertising, compared to being able to, you know, try and get on CNN or something, right, in terms of your profile. And so it has allowed different types of candidates to be able to enter the field. And I think that that is in general a good thing, right, to have more, you know, more openness, right, more ways for different types of people to enter politics. But it is certainly a place where, you know, almost every campaign far down the ballot to the very tippy top is spending a significant portion of strategy and of resources as well.
Well, let's talk for a sec about social media and governance. And I mentioned to you before we went online that I'm teaching a class called Restoring American Statesmanship. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to be talking about the Marshall Plan. And, you know, as someone who studied the Marshall Plan a bit, I realized that even though, you know, we look at it now as this clean, you know, piece of legislation, this historic law, I mean, it was a complex, ugly process by which it was pulled together. And I often think, you know, in the age of, you know, Twitter, or even for that matter, cable TV or talk radio, could a Marshall Plan have been assembled? I mean, it's not hard to imagine the headline, you know, Truman administration proposing bailout for Nazi Germany, you know, Hitler's, you know, former lieutenants who are still, you know, working in Germany. I mean, the way of just kind of condensing issues in a way that would be inflammatory and mm-hmm. would really shape the public debate and governance.
I think that as our politics have gotten more, especially at the elite level, right, like members of Congress, et cetera, have gotten more polarized and more extreme, especially extreme on the right, that has happened, at least this round of it, at the same time, right, as we've seen the rise of social media and its importance in politics. And so I think that, I don't think that we can attribute that trend to social media, but has social media exacerbated it and the attention economy sort of more generally that social media is a part of? I think absolutely, right? Because we see even now, you know, candidates or members of Congress, you know, going on to Twitter or other social media to throw these sort of barbs, right? To tank legislation, right? Rather than maybe trying to hash it out. And it also opens them to other critiques, right? Like sort of what you pointed out about the Marshall Plan, right? And I think that, you know, it's tricky because I think some of those critiques are important critiques that we have not heard as much in the public sphere because social media has allowed other people, you know what I mean? And a broader array of people to be a part of the conversation. But the manner of it on social media also tends to be, as you mentioned, hyperbolic, pithy, exaggerated, right? Because again, that's what gets attention, right? And in a sort of an attention economy. And so I think it would be certainly much harder to have something at that scale happen without there being both more pushback from the public potentially, like on social media, but I think also from, you know, legislators themselves in using their own social media platforms as a way to, you know, cast doubt or barbs, you know, on a piece of legislation like that, that would, you know, but they might come to potentially regret, right, from their constituents.
Right. Well, let's talk for a bit about social media and the academic world. And in some of your writings and interviews, I guess I've developed a renewed appreciation about just really how important Twitter is for, you know, academics, particularly junior academics who are, you know, trying to develop broader contacts, trying to get their work, you know, publicized and so forth. So as someone like yourself or your colleagues, I mean, how important is Twitter and social media more broadly to your work?
Yeah, I mean, in my career, and so like I said, I started grad school in 2013 and I'm right now like going through the 10-year process. So been, you know, about 10 years of being in this world. Twitter has been really important for my academic career. You know, like I have people who I've co-authored studies with because we started talking about something, you know, on Twitter and realized that we shared an interest or could bring different like data sets to bear right on the question. And that's been amazing. And like you said, also expanding your network beyond, you know, as a grad student or as a junior scholar, beyond just at your university, right? And even maybe outside your field, if you're an interdisciplinary scholar, you know, like myself. And so I think it's been really important. I think that, you know, there was this Thursday night in November, and I remember because I was at a conference in New Orleans. And instead of like going out to a drink after dinner, I went back to my hotel room because it was like the night of eulogies for Twitter. It was like right after Elon had like officially bought it and everyone was on Twitter sort of mourning what they thought was going to actually just disappear, right? Like overnight. And you saw a lot of academics mourning what Twitter had done for them, right? I also think, you know, in the same way that we talked about, you know, social movements and other people whose voices have been traditionally, you know, had a much harder time getting into, you know, the press or into the public discourse. Same with academics, right? Like, certainly, like I've been asked to do op-eds after I tweeted about something, right, that related to sort of my area expertise of my research. That has certainly broadened the amount of people and the type of people who are asked to be experts, you know, like in the press and in sort of the public conversation. And so I think it's been really important. I think I'm not yet sure how much it's changed post Elon Musk purchasing Twitter. You know, a lot of people, a lot of academics have left and have joined, you know, other sites like Mastodon or Post. I tried Mastodon. It's just not fun like Twitter is. It seems like very serious. And part of what's great about Twitter is that it's serious and fun, right? And you get to know people. It's not just me sharing my work, right? Like I share my work or I talk about research, but I also people as a human. And I think especially as a, you know, a person who has been lucky, I think, to have some success as a junior scholar, I want to be a real person to other, you know, people more junior than me, to grad students. And I think it's been a way that a lot of people have done that. But I'm not sure sort of what its state is going to be after this, because a lot of people have left, but then a lot of people have stayed too. And so I think it's in a sort of point of flux right now, at least as it relates to academia.
We had about a year ago, a conversation like this with Julian Zelizer, a historian at Princeton, and he had written an article called Twitter and the Historian. And he wrote a couple lines I'd like you to react to. He said, "There is endless space for smart intellectuals to contribute to the debate. That's a good thing." But again, then he goes on to say, "The ease of disseminating ideas, whether via a tweet or Facebook post, has diminished the solidity of information that citizens receive about the news. As a result, we have a public square filled with disinformation and conspiracy theories. This has played out in devastating fashion with issues such as COVID-19, where scientific experts struggle to gain ground against sheer falsehood." What do you think?
I mean, I don't even think. I know that disinformation has been a problem for a very long time, right? This is another thing that has social media exacerbated it to some extent. Absolutely. You know, without a doubt. But I think that view, although I agree with a lot of the sentiments in it, I think that it falls into what I think happens a lot. And the same thing that was sort of reflected in the media Twitter policy from the Times editor. It's that this it's this like false binary that like have both, that if we have this way of knowing and communicating about things on social media, we can't also have this other serious, you know, longer sort of way of talking about things. And I don't think that's true. And I actually think most regular people are pretty good at understanding the difference between a tweet thread about something that, you know, coming from a historian and a historical book, right? And so I don't think people's expectations are that those should be the same thing. And I think that, you know, I think there's a trade-off, and it may not always fall down the same way in every case. But, you know, one of the trade-offs, especially as it relates to different types of academics, whether they're, you know, public health historians, you know, medical scientists, social scientists, and it comes to sort of the way that you can engage more publicly on Twitter, you know, the trade-off is on the one hand, competing, right, for like attention with potentially people who are purveyors of disinformation, right, people who are attacking you for your views. It has to be presented in a different manner, right, shorter, it's never going to be as complete, right, as your like monograph. But on the other hand, it allows so many more people to have access to scientific knowledge, social scientific knowledge, historical and humanistic ways of knowing. I think that's really good too, right? And like I said, that balance may not be the same in all cases and in all disciplines. But I think that, you know, I have tried very hard and obviously I'm not at all alone in this, but I think that the work that we do as scholars should make its way to the public in some way, right? And that it shouldn't just be behind the paywall, you know, of an academic journal. And if people are interested in it, then this is a way that all sorts of different academics can share their work in a more direct and accessible way. And for all its flaws, I think a lot of the time, at least, that's a sort of net positive.
Well, there's been, as you know, lots of articles about just trying to understand how social media is affecting, you know, the country at writ large. And Jonathan Haidt with NYU has written a number of provocative articles in The Atlantic. And the one that grabbed my attention, the headline was, yes, social media really is undermining democracy. And he goes on to say, you know, the evidence is not really clear, but it seems like it might be contributing to the damaging of institutions, institutional trust, you know, teen health. People have talked about that. But he was also talking about just sort of the culture of combat that is part of this. And I want to read a couple sentences and have you react to them. He said, social media has put us all in the middle of a Roman Colosseum, and many in the audience want to see conflict and blood. But once we realize that we are the gladiators, tricked into combat so that we might generate content, engagement, and revenue, we can refuse to fight. We can be more understanding toward our fellow citizens, seeing that we are all being driven mad by companies that use largely the same set of psychological tricks. We can forswear public conflict and use social media to solve our own purposes, which for most people will mean more private communication and less public performances. Maybe that comment there, or even broadly his, you know, his kind of more alarmist critique or questions about how social media is affecting the fabric of our democracy.
Yeah. Social media impacted our culture, our society, our ways of communicating with one another, without a doubt. Is that the reason that our democracy is backsliding, as you know, international organizations that rank countries have said that ours is? I would say definitively no. You know, there is much more danger in the authoritarian and populist are being elected to serve in our government who are tearing down the tenets of democracy while being a part of it than social media. Now, does social media play a role in that? Can it help sometimes those people get elected? Absolutely, right? In terms of just like it can give a pro-democracy movement like Black Lives Matter a platform, so too can it give an authoritarian like the former president a platform, right? But in that case, it's not the social media platform that's the problem. It's that the authoritarian or the, you know, liberal actions of someone on those social media platforms and off of them, that's the problem, right? And I have to say, like in my work, I'm really trying to push back on this sort of like deterministic idea that if we just didn't have social media, our democracy would be fine and we wouldn't be so polarized. We're polarized because our country is slowly lurching towards becoming a true multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy. And there are a core of people, some of them with a lot of institutional power, who don't want that. That is necessarily going to polarize, right? Like movements for social equity and racial equity, et cetera, are going to polarize because there are going to be people who don't want that. Do we see that play out on social media? Absolutely. But in this case, I think what is the problem is the extremity of these sort of authoritarian members of Congress and, you know, former president, et cetera, who are trying to construct democracy from sort of within the institutions of it. And that has very little to do with the way that we talk to one another on social media.
Right. I know you're going to have to run in just a second, but let's I mean, we've made several references to the purchase of Twitter by Elon Musk. You know, it was in the news, you know, endlessly. It seemed like in late December. It's been a little quieter in the last couple of weeks. What has happened to Twitter? Have people left the platform? I've heard kind of anecdotally that more people in kind of the professions are using LinkedIn to communicate. What is the state of affairs with Twitter now?
Calmer than it has been. Like you were saying, when it was sort of some crisis in the news about Elon Musk's purchase of it every other day. There have certainly been a fair amount of people who have left for other platforms or are just using other platforms more when they maybe would have used Twitter for it. I certainly think we see this in, you know, certain academic fields, for example. But the majority of the core groups of people that make Twitter, Twitter, you know, journalists, Black Twitter, politicians, have largely not left the platform. I've noticed problems with the platform just being like not operating as well. Like I won't get a notification when someone mentions me or whatever. Like I think it's just not in as good of logistical shape, you know, as it used to be. But I think, you know, what we saw with the sort of hubbub after Elon Musk's purchase of it is that it made us realize, and I think a lot of my work is hoping that people would have realized this earlier, that like it's really not a great idea to have something that is so central to our political communication system, especially for journalists, owned by one person, right? And that can all of a sudden, you know, be changed, right? That it's this private entity. And so I hope that, you know, is starting to make technologists, you know, the government, people, et cetera, think about, you know, some of the ways that we can harness all of the good things that we have gotten from social media sites like Twitter. How might we build new ones that have the same great benefits, but don't suffer the, you know, all the ills and consequences of being a privately held company, for example, where these really important conversations take place and where if someone has enough money, they can just buy it and change it.
Well, final question, where is your research? Where do you want to take your research in the next couple of years? Are there any specific set of questions that you're really interested in exploring more deeply?
Yeah, so one project that I'm working on is this idea of the struggle that I've observed for journalists to cover anti-democratic and authoritarian candidates in the US and politicians. You know, it doesn't fit into the models of how political journalism has traditionally been done, right, in this country, and especially with the idea of objectivity. So how can, you know, we help think of ways to that news coverage might look like that centers democracy, right? And allows journalists, you know, a way to say election denialism is democratic. There's, you know, there's sort of the sound election. And how can journalists do that without being accused of being called biased or partisan? So I've been, you know, talking to journalists about it and doing some experiments with journalists about, you know, what are some ways that that might work given their editorial and audience, you know, constraints. And that's something that I'm really excited about. And another thing that I'm working on is trying to understand the role of political identity in like social media ads from politicians. So usually we like look at these ads, say on Facebook, and we say they're about this issue, where they're negative or positive, you know, or whatever. And or this has a fact in it, or this has disinformation in it. But I think actually a lot more of it is just about identity. And so trying to understand like how can we conceptualize and capture the range of identities and the way that politicians sort of take advantage of them to craft in groups and out groups that help them electorally.
Great. Well, Janet, I know you're running off to a meeting and we're very grateful that you spent some time with us this morning. I'm going to continue to follow your work. And as we're saying beforehand, you haven't been to SIU. I'd like to coax you to Carbondale and meet students and maybe talk to a class or two and talk about just the important work you're doing. I think we'd all enjoy having you here.
I would love that. And I've enjoyed this conversation so much. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to SimonCast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. SimonCast is produced in collaboration with WSIU Public Radio. You can find SimonCast wherever you listen to podcasts, including NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe to new episodes as soon as they're posted and tell your friends about our show. For more information, visit paulsimoninstitute.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for keeping the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well.